From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 19th day of August 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Dan Zwicker of ADM Grain Group. He's in Decatur, Illinois. In agricultural news, the Secretary of Agriculture has come to the defense of the proposed livestock competition rules. Russia is in the process of lifting its ban on the import of U.S. chicken, and that nation may be set to import as much as 5 million metric tons of coarse grain this year. We'll have details of these and other stories shortly. Also in this half hour, we'll hear the latest from the John Deere Pro Farmer Crop Tour. I bet you heard that nice low ball number for corn in Illinois, but was it put into context with last year's tour data? You'll be surprised if that's not the case. At the end of this half hour, don't forget that meteorologist Peter Levitt will join us to take a look at the agricultural weather forecast and that it all happens on this Thursday edition of the Closing Market Report. The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media from the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
In Chicago, on this Thursday afternoon, futures finished the day like this. Nearby September wheat at 681 and a quarter, up 25 and a quarter cents today. The July for next year settled at 705 and three quarters, 11 and a half cents higher. Hard red winter wheat in Kansas City at 705 and a quarter, up 20 and a quarter. And then came the red, September corn futures, 414 and a quarter, down 4 and a quarter today. December at 429 and a quarter, 4 cents lower, and the March at 441 and one quarter, down 4 3/4. May contract $4.47 and a half, down 5 1/4. July corn at 453 and a quarter, 5 1/2 lower, and next year's December at $4.33 3/4, 6 cents lower. September soybeans at 10.16 3/4, down 18 1/2 cents. November at 10.12 1/4, down 18 1/2, and January at 10.19 1/4, down 18 1/4. The March contract at $10.24, down 16 1/4. September bean meal, at $302.50, down $4.90. September bean oil at $39.89, down 97 cents on the afternoon. The live cattle futures, August contract at $99.17.5, $1.97.5 higher for the day. August feeders at $1.14 and a nickel, up 35 cents. And the lean hog futures in the October contract at $77.85, down 22 1/2 cents. On this Thursday afternoon, you are listening to the Closing Market Report. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. Crude oil, September contract, $74.40 a barrel, down $1.02. Ethanol at $1.85 1/10, 2 4/10 higher. September natural gas at $4.16 7/10, down 7 2/10 of a cent. And the heating oil or diesel fuel for the day at $2.02 of a cent. And that finished 2 2/10 of a cent lower on the afternoon. August gold futures at $1,233.80 an ounce, up $4.10. And the Dow Jones Industrial Average now stands at 10,255. It's just about 161 points lower. The U.S. dollar at 82.45 is up 0.23. The CRB index at 268.22 is down 1.68 on the afternoon. Here's what the weather forecast is calling for yet this afternoon. Mostly sunny skies in the area, high near 90, with south winds around 5 miles an hour. And then tonight it'll be partly cloudy, a low around 66 degrees, says the National Weather Service. South winds around 6 miles an hour. And then Friday, mostly sunny skies, a high near 92, south winds between 6 and 10 miles an hour. Friday night, a 30% chance of showers and thunderstorms, mostly cloudy skies in the area, a low around 69 degrees. And Saturday, a 40% chance of showers and thunderstorms, mostly cloudy, a high near 89, south-southwest winds around 6 miles an hour, and then they'll turn and come from the west to northwest. That means Saturday night will be partly cloudy with a low of 69 degrees and sunny on Sunday with a high of 88 degrees. By the time we get to Sunday night, 65 for the low, mostly clear skies. Monday should be sunny with a high near 89 degrees. More on the agricultural weather forecast when we get to the bottom of the half hour and we talk with meteorologist Pete Levitt.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
You are listening to the Closing Market Report. It's a Thursday afternoon. Dan Zwicker of ADM Grain Group in Decatur, Illinois, is with us to take up the futures markets. Good afternoon to you, Dan.
Hi, Todd.
Let's start with the green on the board. That's in the wheat pit. Nice little jump up 18 cents today, or actually 29 cents for the day.
Yeah. Wheat has been under pressure, of course, the past week and a half, and now we've looks like this 50% retracement level basically is going to try to find some support at that level of the advance from that late June low. Seems to have kind of come into play here, and the market has had at least a nice one-day bounce. I do think, though, from a technical perspective, we need to see some follow-through to kind of firm this thing up. And we're still down for the week. Now, it wouldn't take much the way wheat has been traveling. I think we had a close maybe last Friday somewhere around $7, so we're still 20 lower or so for the week on the September chart here. But if we could get some nice follow-through from a technical perspective, I think then that would argue that we're going to give we're at least going to try to trace out another leg to the upside.
And then turn your attention to the other side with, of course, grains for corn and oil seeds. Are beans pulling the corn lower, and is this coming from the Pro Farmer Crop Tour? What happened here?
Well, that's my guess. My guess is the Pro Farmer Tour, with all their high bean counts or pod counts they had yesterday, the forecasts of some rain moving into this eastern Illinois, western Indiana area that's been kind of been on the short change side of the last 2 to 3 weeks in here. I think that kind of came into play and kind of tipped the beans down in here, and then we hit a bunch of stops.
You have been technically feeling your oats and ready to giddy up. You still want to do it?
Yeah, I'm still in that bull camp, but I do have to also recognize that we've had a nice run. We're basically 7 weeks up from the lows that we had or out of that June report. Anytime you kind of climb a market upwards of 7 weeks, 8 weeks, depending upon how you want to count it, you usually get into a period of consolidation, a period of setback, and I would not be a bit surprised to see some of that take hold here as we go into the end of August. I don't think the rally's over with, though, because until something changes, the underlying supply-demand balance sheets and the underlying trend of this market, I think, is counter-seasonal, and counter-seasonal at this point means higher.
And you're counter-seasonal, and it's demand-driven.
Yeah, I mean, just look at today's numbers, 90 million corn sales. I mean, I think it was the largest, and I don't know, somebody, there's some pretty big years since we've had some of that. Look at the wheat number. Look at the bean number. That bean number is going to continue to keep coming at us. I think you're going to see strong corn sales for some time. I think USDA is underestimating corn demand. We don't necessarily know how it's all going to shake out, depending upon how things do shake out in the Soviet Union. But I think the supply-demand balance sheet on corn looks to me like it's going to tighten further unless this yield goes up through the 165 level, and we'll have to I haven't seen any evidence that we're going to shoot up above that, at least at this point.
Demand domestically in the export market?
It's all exports.
How much more?
I think there's talk in the trade that that number could go to 2-3 maybe. That is probably a little optimistic. USA is at, what, 2050 now. So there is some room to kind of go up higher. All of a sudden, then you've got ending stocks sliding down underneath a billion bushels.
Let's see. So that's a $250 million increase, and historically that'd be a 25-cent rally, right?
Oh, that I don't know. I don't do those kind of correlations.
Well, I was thinking it was about a dime for every 100 million. So.
Oh, well, maybe on a yearly average or something like that. But I think if that would be realized, you're going to have to take this corn market higher because it's, the market is going to want larger supplies. Somehow, and the market's going to encourage farmers to put fertilizer on the ground this fall and grab up every bag of seed corn they can. So I don't think we're quite at those levels that would encourage an automatic corn planting at this time. If those numbers are realized now, those are strictly speculation. You know?
Yeah. Do these kinds of numbers fit into your long-term charts that you've been watching?
Well, let's put it this way: my cyclical work would imply that this counter seasonal rally high that we have, and at this point, my guess is kind of in this October time frame, could be somewhat of an important high, and I would be awful careful wanting to be real bullish that going into 2011, 2012. We do have those 27-year cycle lows coming due in that 12 and 13 area. And looking at the overall economy and whatnot, I guess I'd be a little concerned that we still run the risk of a big flight to safety, big flight to quality, which is a deflationary type move. And that would probably take hold somewhere in 2012 or 2013.
And that shows up, I suppose, in all the grains and the oil?
Yeah, it would be. It's a commodity-driven type market. So it would be, I look at CRB and overall commodity prices. Now, not every commodity is going to do that, but that it would be considered more of a basket of commodities. So, and then, we've been on this rodeo several times over the last several years where everyone gets bulled up on demand, and all of a sudden we overproduce, and we have a good weather, and then we're back in the soup again. So, that's the kind of cycles that we're in agriculture, and something like that might play out again.
Indeed. One final, kind of a different subject. Any talk scuttlebutt inside ADM that's worthwhile hearing, and you might want to repeat about the fertilizer industry and consolidation in Canada?
We're not in the fertilizer business, so that's not on hardly anybody's radar screen. There's nothing really to comment on that.
Okay, just checking. Thanks much, Dan.
Very well.
Hey, Dan Zwicker is with ADM Grain Group. He's out of Decatur, Illinois, and joins us here on the Closing Market Report each and every Thursday afternoon. If you'd like to hear Dan, you can do that again on our website. The address is willag.org. That's willag.org. I'll get that posted up about 3:15 this afternoon. Happens that way each and every day, not with Dan, but with the Closing Market Report. You can listen to it again anytime you'd like, or you can dial this number. It's 217-333-3434. That's 217-333-3434. For a bit of analysis in either the pre-opening, or rather the opening, or the closing market numbers, we post those at about 10:15 and 3:15 daily as well.
Support comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at www.stuart-peterson.com.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from the University of Illinois and Illinois Public Media. Dave Dickey is here now with today's agricultural news.
In agricultural news, USDA Secretary Tom Vilsack yesterday defended his department's livestock competition rule, saying the provisions won't take away producer premiums, but are meant to stop the horror stories that federal officials have heard from livestock producers in recent months. USDA's Grain Inspection Packers and Stockyards Administration proposed the competition rule in June, and the comment period was expected to end next week. The rule has several provisions addressing perceived unfair and anti-competitive practices by packers. Vilsack says that critics of the GPSA rule should keep in mind the losses of livestock producers in each sector that USDA is especially trying to address. In 1988, there were 666,000 hog farmers in the country, but today just 71,000 hog producers. In dairy, the numbers have dropped from 110,000 to 65,000 over the past decade. And in beef, the number of producers has declined from 1.6 million in 1980 to 950,000 now. Russia has partially lifted its ban on U.S. chicken by allowing shipments from 10 U.S. production facilities. Russia is expected to clear one more U.S. plant today. U.S. chicken plants must now be inspected by a delegation of Russians before trade can resume. The 10 U.S. plants initially cleared for export by Russia were not first inspected as a precondition for making shipments. Sources close to Russia's agriculture ministry say Russia could import at least 5 million tons of grain this year following the poor harvest. The source added that the decision to purchase grain has already been taken, though the government has yet to decide on volumes. But the agriculture ministry and its spokesperson told reporters that imports were not under discussion and that no meeting on the matter has been scheduled. The total grain crop is officially expected to reach 60 to 65 million tons. The 2009 harvest was 97 million tons. Russia's annual grain consumption is estimated at 78 million tons. High-ranking Argentina officials say that Argentina hopes to begin talks with China later in the year to help resolve a tit-for-tat trade dispute that ended with a ban of Argentinian soy oil shipments. Argentinian President Cristina Fernandez failed to get Beijing to lift a ban on Argentine soy oil exports worth $1.4 billion a year during a visit to China last month. Argentina has invited a Chinese delegation to visit the country in November. And that's a look at today's agricultural news.
Hey, thanks, Dave. Dave Dickey is Director of Agricultural Programming for Illinois Public Media. That's public radio for the farming world. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Well, the John Deere Pro Farmer Crop Tour is into its fourth day now. But after wrapping up yesterday, they had some results from the state of Illinois. After all their samples were calculated, the tour found an average corn yield for Illinois at 166.53 bushels to the acre. That's down just 0.4%, 0.4%, that is, 0.4% at 167.17 bushels to the acre measured last year. So just about a half bushel difference from this year to last year. Scouts were a bit surprised, though, since USDA on August 1st projected the Illinois yield up 3.45%. Of course, it's now, what, the 19th day of August? That's 20 days of hot and dry weather since the first day of August, and prior to that when USDA had taken its numbers. Grain length is probably the key, according to the Pro Farmer Scouts. They say data revealed an average grain length in the state of 6.2 inches. That compared to 6.47 inches last year. On the soybean side, the Scouts found a whopping 1,308.31 pods in a 3x3 square. That's up 18.6% from the 1,102.8 pods measured last year. But of course, remember, last year's results were quite a decline from the 2008 too. So that brought things back nicely, according to the Scouts. Chip Flory will be our guest on Friday's Commodity Week. Of course, he's been out all week on the Crop Tour. It's sponsored by Pioneer Hybrid. It's nearing its end, and Chip now says he's got some observations about the western leg of the tour, especially Iowa. He talked with Leslie Smith of the NAFB.
Traveling on the Pro Farmer Midwest Crop Tour, I'm Leslie Smith. As day three is in the books, we made our way from Nebraska City into Spencer, Iowa. And join me is Chip Flory. And definitely, it's been a good tour so far as we've covered now one-third of Iowa. I guess, what is the difference that we're seeing in this area in terms of what we saw a year ago?
But when everything is said and done, I'm not too sure if this crop was a whole lot different than the crop that we looked at a year ago. And it's all because of that maturity pace. And it's all because this year's crop is going to have test weight. And it's because this year's crop is going to get harvested at 17-18%, not 25-26% like it was a year ago. So major, major differences between the crop from last year and this year. I am, however, a little disappointed that we didn't have some better grain length. We had too much tip back on the ears. Seemed like, you know, we pulled the 5th, the 8th, and the 11th ear off of one sample row, so we've got 3 sample ears, and it seemed like every time we had one runt in the litter. It just, we had that one tip back ear that caused us some problems and resulted in that average grain length being down from a year ago. Our ear counts were nothing spectacular, but they were similar to a year ago. The kernel rows around, that never changes too much, but it's part of the calculation, and we've got to have that in there. And the row width obviously isn't going to change too much from year to year. So this year, the reason that we've got a smaller measured or calculated yield in crop districts 7, 4, and 1 is because of that shorter grain length. And it might be that the shorter grain length was there because the crop is just a month ahead of what we saw a year ago.
In terms of the soybean crop, seems to be maybe that is actually really consistent with what we saw a year ago.
It's a good bean crop. And that is the thing that is most consistent with a year ago. Last year's bean crop was really, really good in the state. Not only was it really good in the third week of August, but it had moisture to go ahead and finish. This year's bean crop is really good again, and it's got moisture to go ahead and finish. The biggest difference is the number of pods out there, and we saw a significant increase so far in the state of Iowa for those for the total number of pods in a 3x3-foot square. The thing that I'm going to caution people about, though, is that a big pod count does not automatically translate into a big bean yield. And that is because of the simple fact that the size of the bean is yet to be determined, and the size of the bean is responsible for about one-third of the soybean yield. So we've still got a lot yet to determine on this bean yield. But we got a lot of pods. Man, we got a lot of pods. We're up 15%, something like that, on average through the western one-third of Iowa. That's a big increase. And we've got some awesome yield potential. Now, the question is how well will this bean crop hold on to the yield potential that it has right now?
For the last day on the crop tour, we move from Spencer, Iowa into Minnesota. The Pro Farmer Midwest Crop Tour being presented by Pioneer. I'm Leslie Smith.
Our thanks to Leslie Smith of the National Association of Farm Broadcasting for that report with Chip Flory from Pro Farmer. You're listening to the Closing Mark Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. Back in 2 minutes when we'll take a complete look at the agricultural weather forecast with Pete Lavitt. I'm Todd Gleason.
It's National Soft Ice Cream Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1785, Seth Thomas was born. An American clock manufacturer, Thomas was one of the pioneers in the mass production of clocks. In 1851, Charles E. Hyers was born. Myers invented a particular flavored root beer. As a Philadelphia pharmacist, he sampled a herb tea while visiting New Jersey. Back home, he created a similar drink, Hires Herb Tea, with sassafras as the main flavoring ingredient. He sold the mixture at the 1876 Philadelphia Centennial Exposition in tiny packets containing barks, herbs, and berries for housewives to brew as root beer. In 1856, Gale Borden was granted a patent for a process to make condensed milk, which he developed in 1853. Condensed milk could be preserved for long periods of storage. His company's advertising slogan, "The milk from contented cows," was a tremendous success. The flat-top cans are still available today. And in 1887, Spencer Fullerton Baird died. An American naturalist and zoologist, he was the second secretary of the Smithsonian Institution. And that's This Day in Agricultural History.
Listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a Thursday afternoon. Pete Levitt, agricultural meteorologist, now joins us to take a look at the weather forecast. Good afternoon to you, Pete.
Good afternoon, Todd.
It is the third Thursday of the month, and that means the government has some outlooks for the future in terms of weather. What did they say this time around?
Well, this time around, they're going with persistence in the short term, and they're going with the La Nina climatology in the longer term. For this next month of September, they're looking for above normal temperatures from the central Mississippi Valley eastward to the Atlantic coast, and also in the southwestern United States. The only place they have below normal temperatures forecast is in the Pacific Northwest. And for precipitation, they've got rains above normal along the Gulf Coast, Florida, and the South Atlantic coast. They've got a dry in the southwestern U.S., and the rest of the country, which includes almost all of the Midwest and the growing areas, they have what they call equal chances, meaning they're not making a forecast, essentially. For the fall, the pattern is pretty much the same, September, October, November, except they've increased the above-normal temperature prospects from the southwestern U.S. right on through the central U.S. into the Great Lakes in the Northeast. Precipitation, they have it above normal, only in Nebraska and South Dakota and the Pacific Northwest. This is for the fall months of September, October, November. So the implications of all of this are that not making a forecast really in the Midwest, we're going to go with what we always like to use, which has proved, again, a very useful concept in forecasting, that's persistence. Once again, we had another wet week in Iowa, Wisconsin, a lot of the western Corn Belt. This has gone on really since Memorial Day weekend out there, above normal precipitation. And then when you come across the Mississippi into the eastern Corn Belt, we've had weather patterns much more reflective of normal as far as precipitation is concerned, maybe a few spots a little below normal, but pretty much ideal type of showery pattern for growing conditions. The only difference is being that it's been very warm. It's been above normal temperatures throughout most of these areas, especially east of the Mississippi. That's what we see today, temperatures up in the 90s again in southern and central Illinois and in the upper 80s to low 90s east of there. As you go west, we see an approaching frontal system about to move into Iowa. That means more showers and thunderstorms, mostly tomorrow night. That front actually gets all the way across to the Mississippi River Valley on Friday night and Saturday, where we'll see a batch of showers, thunderstorms, some of them maybe locally severe and maybe some locally heavy rains, but then the front fades as it comes eastward. We only get a quarter to three-quarters of an inch for Illinois and then on eastward into Indiana and Ohio. So it's really a more of the same pattern that we're looking at.
Thank you so much for joining us and telling us all about the agricultural weather. We do appreciate it.
Hi, thank you, Todd.
Mm-hmm. Pete Leavitt, agricultural meteorologist, joins us here on the Closing Market Report on a Thursday afternoon. Stay with us, if you can, for the farming world.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and Moline. More information is available from Tim Wells in Moline at 309-797-7369. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
This is the Farming World, news and interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today we'll talk with Rocky Lundy. He's the executive director of the Mint Industry Research Council and based in Great Falls, Montana. Mr. Lundy, thanks so much for joining us on the program today. We're really appreciative of having you with us.
Thank you, Todd. Pleasure to be here.
Well, the mint industry, we know that Indiana at one time, and I don't know whether it still is or not, used to be a great place to raise mint in the United States, and one of the primary mint-producing states, number one, I think, not only in the nation, but on the planet. Why don't you tell me about the industry today?
Well, it's most people aren't aware that the peppermint and spearmint flavors that they're familiar with are actually one of the few remaining natural flavors. You know, it's most of the flavors nowadays are all synthetic. But mint is still grown as a plant, harvested and steam distilled on the farm. And the oil, which is very concentrated, is extracted on the farm, put in the barrels, and sold eventually to companies such as William Wrigley Jr. or for chewing gum, or Colgate Palmolive for toothpaste. An interesting note would be between those two products, that those two products are responsible for 90% of purchasing 90% of the mint that's grown in the country. And it's really one of the true American heritages. And what I mean by that is mint roots. It's a sterile plant. The commercial mint plant is. It's sterile. It doesn't produce seeds. So it needs to be vegetatively propagated, much like strawberries, which has its advantages but has its disadvantages. Well, when the early settlers came over to this country, they had their mint roots from England. They had their mint roots with them. And when they first started colonizing, they would plant mint in the garden. And back in those days, it was used both in the kitchen for cooking and also, say, for medicinal purposes, which today there are documented studies about its beneficial effects on digestion. You know, the old tale of an after-dinner mint, well, it really does stimulate digestive enzymes in a person's stomach. And it started, like I'm saying, in Massachusetts, and Americans, farmers, were really the pioneers of it. What I mean by that is one person, history really doesn't, it's a little vague in there, but decided somewhere along the line to put the mint hay in, say, an old metal wash tub full of water, put a fire under it, and boil it. Well, then the mint oil, being lighter than water, floated to the top. He skimmed it off, and he had a new product to go peddle into the big city. And then, you know, in the 1880s or so, chewing gum was invented, and they added that for flavor, and on and on and on. But then it migrated, say, from Massachusetts towards the Midwest, in Michigan, Ohio, and Indiana. And to this day, there's very few acres in Michigan, even though there's, I would say there's still six growers, mint growers up there, around St. John's area, the Lansing area. And in fact, there's an old town named Mentha, which means, that's the genus of the mint plant. And there was an actual mint plantation 100 years ago in Mentha, Michigan. Today, there's no mint grown in Ohio anymore. There, as you mentioned, Indiana was the center of mint production up until, say, 1930, 1940. They still have the big mint festival at North Judson, which is always fun to attend. But one problem with growing mint that is traced back, it was identified in 1940 by a plant pathologist from Michigan State, as a disease called verticillium wilt. And we have a strain specific to mint that once it's in the soil and in the fields, it stays there forever. I know of growers that the term's called wilted out, which means that the levels of verticillium got so high that they could not produce a crop. That they hadn't grown mint in that field for 50 years, and they tried to grow it and still could not grow it. The vert wilt was still there. And that's really the reason it kept migrating, even from, there was no reason for it to really move out of Massachusetts. But, and back then they didn't know what it was. They actually thought that the mint plant was, you know, absorbing all the nutrients from the, you know, kind of wearing the soil out, and that's why it wouldn't grow anymore. But it was verticillium wilt, which, you know, is a disease in many crops, tomatoes, potatoes. Let me try to tie that back into the mint plant being a sterile clone, is we have no conventional breeding tools to say, like some crops have. They've gone back to old relatives, and there's many, many old mint plants relatives out there that are verticillium wilt resistant, but since it's a sterile plant, we can't crossbreed back to improve any of the varieties. So it kept migrating, and eventually Indiana's number one status was replaced by Oregon on the West Coast. And I'm saying that that's why it kept migrating towards the West, was the verticillium wilt. And through the research of state land grant universities over the last 30 or 40 years, including Purdue and Michigan State and others you're familiar with, we've learned how to manage verticillium wilt simply by always trying to plant certified clean rootstock and then, you know, rotate to another crop that is not susceptible to wilt. Rotate out probably every 3 years, and that seems to help the growers stay in business, although the yields do continue to drop, you know, from the vert wilt. But I know that's a long answer to your question, but...
Oh, that's okay. Can you tell me, I think I read that the common way to market mint was in a 55-gallon drum, the mint oil, correct?
Correct, a 55-gallon galvanized steel drum. And to maybe put it in perspective to the listeners about how concentrated mint oil is, that one drum for 55 gallons of mint oil flavors 3.2 million sticks of chewing gum.
And how many acres of mint would you have in order to distill that much oil?
In Indiana, they're probably averaging about four. It's sold in pounds on the interstate market on pounds, which is about a pint. And my feelings on why it was developed like that is back in, say, 100 years ago, if it was sold, say, by the gallon or something, there's always somebody, you know, that's a little bit deceitful that could adulterate that and say, water it down or add methyl alcohol or something if you just sold it by that. So we know what a specific pound, the volume of a specific pound of mint oil is based on its specific gravity. So it keeps it true. So anyway, a pound is about a pint, and in Indiana, say, they would be yielding about 40 pounds per acre. And I don't have my calculator handy. The dealers have to do the math themselves to figure out how many acres if you're getting, say, 40 pints to the acre. Or maybe you can do that while we're talking.
I can. I've got a calculator in front of me. So the calculation says, how do I do the calculation? Because I don't know how much the weight is for a gallon.
Well, let's see. A pint is 16 ounces, and there's 128 ounces in a gallon.
Right.
So how many pints in a gallon then? We have eight. Is that eight?
Mm-hmm.
And the growers are getting, let's say 45 pounds, which is 45 pints. Same thing as 45 pints.
Right.
So 45 pints divided by 8 will give us gallons.
Right.
What's that come out to?
5.6.
Five. So let's say 100, we're looking at 100 acres in Indiana to fill one of those 55-gallon drums. And, the reason I probably didn't know that off the top of my head is because the yields do vary. And, in fact, I mentioned Oregon. Oregon average yield is twice that. It's like around 90. And the reasons for that is production. I mean, it's all economics. The production cost of an Indiana grower are so much less. They would be more than half less than, say, that of Oregon, simply because, a lot of land in Indiana and other places is on a rental. Absentee landowners, they rent them out. Also, most of the acres in Indiana that grow mint and other crops are not supplemental irrigation water, pumping from groundwater wells and spring and having hired men out there to change pipes and whatnot. Whereas out in the far west, as we call it, Oregon, Washington, it's all under irrigation, usually under sprinkler. There are some flood irrigation fields in some areas, but also the pests involved with production. In Indiana, there are hardly ever any insect pests. It's just the way it is. Once in a while, they'll have a flare-up of something, but usually not so. And the big problem with mint anywhere is weeds, and there's reasons for that. But back to the insect pest, you take Oregon, they've got every pest known. And mint is very unique in that there's at least three or four insect-type pests that are just specific to mint, and they're very devastating once you get them. Mint root borer is one. Mint flea beetle is another one. That it's the only pest that attacks is mint. But out in Oregon, there are so many voracious insect-type pests that just over the years from all the different crops that, say, are grown in the Willamette Valley, have built up in the populations and attack crops. So they really have their work cut out for them as far as pest control in those areas. In some areas of Oregon production, the mint really won't go dormant, and that means the weeds don't go dormant either. I know mint growers that in around Christmas time might be out spraying the fields for, winter annuals and biennials. So the production cost, even though it sounds like, oh, geez, their yields are doubled, the economics still favor, production in Indiana and the Midwest. Mm.
We're talking this afternoon with Rocky Lundy. He is the executive director of the Mint Industry Research Council. He's in Great Falls, Montana. More with him when we return here on The Farming World.
This is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. Deere & Company's fiscal third quarter earnings jumped 47%, topping Wall Street expectations as the company's sales and margins improved amid what the company called strong demand for its big farm machinery. Deere also said it expects equipment sales to be up about 32% in the fourth quarter from year earlier levels. For the quarter ending July 31st, Deere reported a profit of $617 million, or $1.44 a share, up from $420 million, or 99 cents a share a year earlier. Revenue jumped 16% to $6.84 billion. Equipment sales rose 18% for the quarter. Agriculture and turf sales climbed 12%, while profit jumped 72%. Taiwan's export-reliant economy surged 12.5% year-on-year in the second quarter on strong foreign demand for electronics. It was Taiwan's third consecutive quarter of expansion since its economy emerged from the global recession. Taiwan raised its growth forecast for 2010 from 6.1% to 8.2%, saying the island's exports could reach a record high $271.3 billion this year. And Sears Holdings Corporation cut its second quarter loss by more than half as profit margins perked up at its Kmart chain. And that's a look at today's business news.
This is the Farming World. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today we've been talking with Rocky Lundy, the executive director of the Mint Industry Research Council. He's in Great Falls, Montana. Let's see. When we finished up, we were discussing production costs. Let's talk about what that 55-gallon drum of mint might be worth. I suppose quite a little bit of money.
Yeah, Todd, if you got your calculator, take 55. I'll just do an average, say $20 a pound. The 55, it's like a checking account.
It's about $10,000, if I remember correctly, from the press releases.
Yes, and in fact, there's stories I believe it was in the mid-'80s, where Mother Nature was not kind to the growers in the Midwest in particular, and with the drought situation. So the prices of mint oil just went through the roof. I mean, we're talking hundreds of dollars a pound. And there were stories of growers that actually made their deliveries, you know, in the farm truck with the barrels on there, and they had a car of armed guards in front of the truck, in the back of the truck, just to make sure. And it is money in like a checking account. Back in the old days, things have changed as far as markets. A grower could store that oil. I mean, it's good for 10 or 20 years. He could store it in the shed and kind of wait until the market prices, you know, depending on time of year and stuff, got higher. And if he didn't need the money, he could hold it and sell it then. But that spot market or is kind of gone nowadays, and much like other crops, you better have a contract signed with a buyer to grow mint now.
I've got two other questions I want to talk about, and of course we don't have that much time left, so if you can sort of be brief on these. One of them is global marketplace. And what's happening with the import of mint, but let's take that up in just a moment. The other is I've heard some interesting stories about the on-farm contraptions, and I'll call them contraptions because I really haven't seen one, that are used for the harvest of mint. What's that look like, and how much work is it?
Well, Todd, in your neck of the woods, you'd get a kick out of visiting a mint farm during harvest and distillation. Basically, the process has stayed the same since it was first invented. It's the grower has to have a huge horse-powered steam boiler, you know, and they're big pieces of equipment, and some type of shed. And then the rest of it's all specialized equipment, too. The grower picks the windrow up, runs the hay through a chopper, much like a silage chopper, adjusts the teeth to where it's about an inch and a half size piece of hay through there. And it gets blown into what we call a tub. It's just a big semi-bed type looking thing, but it's a self-contained. It's got four walls. It can be the trap doors can be shut and sealed airtight. He drives that over there to the boiler then, or what we call the distillery, and hooks the steam lines. Steam's being generated in the boiler. Hooks the steam lines to the bottom of that tub. Steam comes through perforated pipes in the bottom and flows through that hay, and then goes back to the distillery where he will have condensers. It's kind of like an old moonshine still, and the process is still is the same. And then the steam, the coils are surrounded by cold water, which condenses it back into a liquid. Then it goes from there into a receiving can, they call it, and basically physics takes over, and oil, being lighter than water, floats to the top. He skims the oil off into those 55-gallon barrels, and he continues to do that. And a lot of those operations, they'll run at 24 hours a day. It's pretty intense kind of thing. And there again, the initial capital cost, a grower just doesn't get into it in the short run. It's like he doesn't just plant it 1 year and decide he doesn't like to grow mint, because he's putting up a lot of capital, $1 million in equipment and distillery to grow mint. So it's not for the weak-hearted. There's a lot of high management involved, as I mentioned, especially with herbicides and weed control. Mint is not a deep-rooted crop. 90% of the roots are in the top foot. It loves water, so the weeds get a jump on it, emerges late, and just outcompete it. So yeah, They're constantly fighting weeds.
We have about a minute and a half left. Speaking of constantly fighting, it appears that the mint industry is in a battle to hold on to domestic production.
Yeah, I'll throw some numbers at you. Between, 1997 and 2007, the number of farms went from close to 1,000 to 350. And the U.S., we one time had about 75% of the world's market of mint oil. Everybody loves our mint oil. They still do. But, the price drives everything. And then in the mid-90s, India and China got into the mint game, and that was responsible for that reduction in farms. Our total production, say, in 1996 was 12 million pounds. Now we're at, I would say, I'd be a little bit liberal saying 9 million pounds. And it's due to the foreign competition. They're not driving John Deere tractors over there, and it's hard to compete.
Mm-hmm. Rocky Lundy is the executive director of the Mint Industry Research Council. He came to us today from his head office there in Great Falls, Montana. This is The Farming World. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. You have a good day.